Reports now that a former Soviet counterintelligence officer was at that meeting with Donald Trump Jr. last year. This hour, we review another week of Drip, Drip, Drip. Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Political scientist Donna Hoffman joins us first to talk specifically about Senator Grassley's role in the Russia probe. Also today, an investigation launched in Ottumwa this week after three dogs die in a hot vehicle. I talk with the AP's Ryan Foley about the end of a prison case that's been called a remarkable injustice. And we recall the abduction and deaths of two Eastern Iowa girls 5 years ago that remains unsolved. Buckle up for your news buzz. First, this news from NPR.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up a little bit later this hour, we'll talk about an investigation launched this week in Ottumwa after three dogs died. They were left in a hot vehicle last weekend during a dog show. Also toward the end of the program, we'll recall the abduction and deaths of two Eastern Iowa girls 5 years ago. It's a mystery that remains unsolved. But first, well, 6 days after that original New York Times bombshell from last Saturday, that one with a Kremlin-linked lawyer meeting the Trump campaign in June of 2016, the story growing with new developments. Joining us to give us some analysis, Donna Hoffman, Department Head and Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Donna.
Hi, Ben.
Another big week of developments, also within the last few hours. Let's start with that. I know Senator Grassley ties into this story a number of times this week. Developments from NBC News, the scoop here, an additional person attending that June 9th, 2016 meeting, a Russian-American lobbyist who was a former Soviet counterintelligence officer there with the president's son, with Jared Kushner, with Paul Manafort, then campaign manager. Talk about your assessment of the developments we've seen this week, including this last one.
Well, you know, one of the things we see with this particular story about the Trump Jr. story, we might think of it, is that the story develops, and so something comes out, and then it gets kind of renewed or reviewed or revised, and so this is kind of a piece with that. So apparently there was this other former Soviet citizen who was accompanying Veselnitskaya, the original person who was of interest and was talked about. But the second person now had not been talked about in the disclosures or especially named up to this point. I do understand that he's come out and said that, yes, he was there. And so you get kind of, again, this alteration of the story that makes the story live even longer and get, you know, renewed attention. Not that this story is going to go away anytime soon, but the drip, drip, drip of revelations here can be really problematic for the Trump administration because it can make them look like they're not being forthcoming in terms of who was there, what happened, and what the real story is, which means that you're going to get investigators being continually interested in getting to the truth of what happens here because there's so many different threads that slowly are being revealed.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Senator Grassley's involvement in particular. Midweek, we found out that our Senator Grassley, head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, along with the Democratic head, Dianne Feinstein, they're writing a letter or have written a letter to Donald Trump Jr. requesting that he testify before their committee. Let's listen to a little bit of audio gathered by CNN in a hallway in our nation's capital. He was asked for the reason for this invitation for Donald Trump Jr. to testify.
It's raised a lot of questions, but the real way that I feel comfortable inviting him is ever since President Trump was elected, it seems like every conversation that has come from somebody in the family where there's been some sort of issue, they've seemed always to be very, very open. And I just think that he would welcome the opportunity to say whatever he wants to say.
Would you subpoena him?
Let's wait and see what he does from our letter.
Okay, welcome the opportunity. Perhaps, we don't know, Donna. Talk a little bit about Chuck Grassley's involvement here and his concerns.
Right. Well, as you mentioned, Grassley is chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and they're one of the two committees in the Senate, and then there are another two committees in the House that are looking into various aspects of the investigation here related to collusion and the election and obstruction of justice, et cetera. And so Grassley has a continuing interest, though, in terms of oversight of the executive branch. And one of the things a committee that has oversight in this area can do is call people in. They can subpoena them. I do think Grassley has since come back and indicated that he would be willing to subpoena Trump Jr. He also has asked Paul Manafort to come to that committee as well to testify. He's also said that he would be willing to subpoena him to appear as well. But Grassley in particular, if you look at the thread that kind of connects all of his statements and things that he seems to be talking about in this area, relate back to something called the Foreign Agent Registration Act. And so he's concerned with this law that Congress wrote back in the 1930s, where foreign agents, because we don't want them to have undue influence in the workings of the U.S. government, that they have to register. They have to tell us that they're lobbying for a foreign interest. And it's quite complex in terms of what you do in this regard, so that we know what is going on. And so Grassley has talked a number of times with this new person that NBC just identified being at the meeting back earlier in the year. Grassley had raised his name as part of the investigation into the Steele dossier, which was the not substantiated information that was gathered by a British intelligence person on Donald Trump. And this particular person was named in terms of, again, Grassley being concerned about him because of failure to register in the Foreign Agent Registration Act. And it is also something earlier in the week when this came out that Veselnitskaya, the original Russian who met with Trump and Manafort and Kushner, he raised questions about why she was there. Why was she still in the country? Why she hadn't registered under the Foreign Agent Registration Act? And so these will be questions that Grassley will be concerned with, which are really kind of focused and minute, and some people may not see them as relating to kind of the overall, the larger picture of what's going on here. But other people on the committee then, once they have Manafort, once they have Trump Jr. before them in the committee, can ask them all kinds of questions.
Right. So let's zoom out a little bit in the last couple minutes of our conversation here, Donna. How do you gauge GOP support for Trump as this drip, drip, drip continues? Do you see distancing, more and more distancing? Do you see a point in which the GOP will turn against Trump in some more significant fashion?
Well, we have not really seen a whole lot of distancing of Republicans yet, even though there have been multiple things that in other kinds of events and scandals that we've seen throughout history, we might have expected that. We haven't seen that. And in part, that's because Trump remains popular with his base. And so the Republicans in Congress, most recently about the email revelations, have been, you know, kind of cagey in terms of it's not something we think, you know, we would normally do, but they're kind of waiting for some more information to come out, giving the Trump family in particular some benefit of doubt in this regard. And so, you know, Paul Ryan earlier said in relationship to Grassley's comments about bringing Trump Jr. before the committee, yeah, I believe people should, you know, talk about this, that he should be open to doing that. And so they're holding their cards kind of close to their vest. Would we expect Republicans to turn on Trump in terms of revelations? Here, they haven't so far, but nevertheless, things do, as we've mentioned, keep dripping out here, and the 2018 elections keep getting closer, and members of Congress who are up for re-election will be monitoring how popular Trump is or is not within their own constituencies. And, you know, the health care bill plays a role in this, too, that is being rolled out this week again and has proven to be pretty unpopular and so with constituents. And so members of Congress have to be very strategic in terms of their positioning here, not just on the Trump, you know, investigation here, but also in terms of policy issues, especially health care.
Okay. Donna Hoffman, thank you for your analysis. Department head and associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa after another very busy week of developments from Washington. Donna, great to have your analysis. Thanks.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowa prison officials have dropped all sanctions imposed on an Iowa inmate for his role in an alleged gang rape that he says never happened. It's the end of a prison case that's been called a remarkable injustice. Reporting on it, Ryan Foley, correspondent with the Associated Press based in Iowa City. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, Ben.
So this case goes way back to the year 2009. Tell us, in the 5 minutes we have, first of all, what happened?
Well, we're still a little unclear on what exactly happened, but back in 2009, officials at the Newton Correctional Facility received a report that an alleged gang rape had happened months earlier, and they started looking into it, and eventually they didn't file any criminal charges, but they pursued disciplinary misconduct proceedings against five inmates that they said had raped one of their fellow inmates, who he alleged that this occurred for hours. One of the inmates has been fighting this, insisting it never occurred. Seven and a half years later, they've now dropped all allegations against him and rolled back his punishment that he received, which was, the loss of 1 year of earned time.
Mm-hmm. So the inmate in question is a man named Joe Bird, serving time there. And we should mention here, shouldn't we, Ryan? Is there a lower level of proof needed to take correction action? Right.
Yeah. This case really highlighted what critics would say is kind of the fundamental unfairness of the inmate disciplinary hearings, where basically they can routinely use secret evidence. They do not have attorneys to represent them. They only have a limited ability to present evidence and call witnesses. And there's a low standard of proof that allows the judges to find that they're guilty, even if only some evidence supports that conclusion. So it's a far lower burden of proof than, a criminal case or many other proceedings.
Mm-hmm. In your reporting, you have a retired prison judge calling the case one of the biggest apparent miscarriages of justice during his 42-year career, and he says he's handled 100,000 cases. This is remarkable.
It's extraordinary. That judge, a guy named William Supine, he was the chief administrative law judge at the Anamosa State Prison for years, and he was initially assigned to handle the disciplinary hearing against Joe Bird, and he started reviewing the confidential evidence, and he came to the conclusion that he didn't believe that the accuser was credible, that he didn't believe that a rape actually occurred. And he told the Department of Corrections that he was planning to dismiss the case unless they came forward with more credible evidence. Well, instead of doing that, they instead removed William Supine from the case because the judges report to the Department of Corrections. So they took this very unusual step of removing him from the case, transferring the case to another prison judge who had already found the other four guilty, and very soon Bird was found guilty and given the maximum punishment of 365 days of isolation and 365 days of lost earned time.
Hmm. We have just a few seconds left, but very quickly, I understand from your reporting, Department of Corrections officials here in Iowa have had no immediate comments. I don't know if they have in the meantime, but where does this go from here?
Well, they just say that they're declining comment on the reason why they are dropping all sanctions after defending this for 7.5 years. saying that they do not comment on litigation. But more broadly, where it goes from here, it will be interesting to see if they take any steps to change the inmate disciplinary hearing process to possibly make it a little bit more fair. They've been under some pressure to do that. The state ombudsman issued a pretty hard-hitting report 2 years ago that called for some reforms. And folks would certainly say this case would add to that pressure potentially. So we'll see.
Okay, Ryan Foley, thanks for your reporting and for this conversation. Correspondent with the Associated Press based in Iowa City. Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks for having me on.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. An investigation was launched this week in Ottumwa after three dogs were left in a hot vehicle last weekend. It was during a dog show in that city. We're joined now by Scott Wilson, Animal Welfare Intervention Coordinator with the Animal Rescue League of Iowa. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Ben. How are you doing?
Hi. Very sad, of course, always to hear about these types of deaths. What were the circumstances as you understand them?
Well, a lot of information isn't available yet because the Ottumwa police are still investigating. But it sounds like at some point on Saturday, four dogs were placed in a vehicle. It's believed the vehicle may have been running with the air conditioning on at the time the dogs were placed in the vehicle. Sometime while the dogs were in the vehicle, it looks like there was a mechanical failure and the air conditioning stopped working. And when someone actually noticed that that had happened, two dogs had already died. One dog was still alive and transported to the vet, but died at the veterinarian office, and then one dog survived the incident.
Mm-hmm. And the person looking after the dogs, the person's vehicle, this was someone connected with the dog show?
Apparently, it sounds as if it was a handler who had been hired by the dog's owners to actually show the dogs.
Mm. Okay, so we'll wait for the outcome of that investigation. I saw potential charges here. Animal cruelty, neglect, is that what would be coming into question?
Potentially it could be animal abuse since the person responsible for this actually didn't own the dogs.
Okay, and the penalty for such crime, do you know offhand?
I believe it's up to a year in jail and up to I'm not sure about the fine exact without looking at it.
Mm-hmm. Give us some basics when we hear about this. A lot of people leave their dogs in their car. They run in for an appointment, to shop. Perhaps they're delayed more than they thought they would be. And during these months, it can get superheated in a car in the sunshine, can't it?
Absolutely. The Animal Rescue League, Animal Control, during the summer, we respond to, on an average, several calls a week of dogs being left in cars by people who go to the grocery store and think they're only going to be gone for a couple of minutes. And there are charts out there online that will show you that on an 80-degree day, within 10 minutes of a dog being in a car, the temperature is up to 99 degrees. And within 30 minutes, it's up to 114 degrees. And this just gets progressively worse. It was near 100 in Ottumwa when this incident occurred. At 95 degrees, the temperature in a car gets to 114 in 10 minutes and 129 degrees in 30 minutes. And that's more than enough to kill a dog that doesn't have any ventilation, any shade, any water.
And does it matter if you leave that inch crack in the windows?
It really doesn't. Cars act like greenhouses, so even a small crack is not going to impact the interior temperature that much.
Mm-hmm. Is there any time? What tips do you have if you have to leave your dog in the car? Would you ever recommend that that's possible under certain conditions?
Honestly, I don't. I mean, even if it's not the temperature, there are other things a dog can do. A dog can actually accidentally knock a gear shifter from park to neutral, jumping around the car. Other things can happen. The best bet is don't take your dog with you if you're going to have to leave it in the car, and definitely not if the temperature is going to be above 70 degrees or it's really bright and sunny. Just leave your dog at home.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you quickly before we have to go about another investigation. 85 chickens and roosters from a property on the east side of Des Moines were seized by the Animal Rescue League of Iowa, your organization, and the Des Moines Police Department this week. This is the fourth large-scale rescue of the Animal Rescue League that has assisted authorities so far this year. So this is an illegal animal fighting case. Tell us about it quickly.
Well, cockfighting and dogfighting, you don't hear much about it because of very underground activity, but it is alive and well in Iowa. It's just a matter of catching them, developing the information. The Des Moines Police Department and the Animal Rescue League worked very closely together to develop this case, and we were just fortunate to get enough information for the police department to pursue charges on it.
Mm-hmm. How is this communicated? Of course, is it through social media that the people in the know when these animal fights will be and can attend them? I'm just curious here.
Normally, it's a very closed circuit, so the only people who are going to be invited to a dog or cock fight are going to be people who know the participants or are known by the participants personally. The days of, you know, hearing about them on chat boards and such are pretty well gone. It's gone to direct communication or just word of mouth.
Mm-hmm. Back to the first story that we mentioned, dogs more broadly, not just left in cars, but we have to watch out when we just take them out for walks, don't we, certain breeds?
Oh, absolutely. Actually, any dog, concrete heats up very quickly, and if you're out walking your dog, I have seen several cases of dogs with burns that have actually peeled the paw pads off from being on concrete for too long. I mean, if you want an example, wait until a warm day, go out and walk around on your driveway in your bare feet and just see how hot it gets.
Right.
It's a lot of quick damage. Dogs with longer hair need a lot more grooming this time of year because mats in the fur coat will trap heat next to the body and cause sores to start developing underneath the fur. Mm-hmm. And short-haired dogs are subject to sunburn, so they need a source of shade so they can actually get out of the direct light of the sun.
So we should not use ourselves as a yardstick, is what I hear you're saying, Scott. Is just because we're out and we're comfortable with whatever heat, it doesn't mean our dogs are safe.
No. Dogs, cats are a lot more sensitive to temperature than humans are. You know, we have the ability to put on clothes, take off clothes, put on sunscreen. Our pets have no protection in this except for what we give them.
Mm-hmm. Tragic story of the dogs left that died in the vehicle in Ottumwa. What should you do if you come across a vehicle in a parking lot or somewhere and you see a dog in there? What action can you take? Should you take?
You should immediately contact the authorities. Iowa law does not recognize a citizen's right to break into a vehicle to rescue an animal. Only law enforcement or animal control can actually do that. So you do put yourself in a position of some legal liability if you take it upon yourself to rescue the animal. Plus, you don't know if that dog in the car is aggressive or not. And if you break open the window, you could get yourself into a lot of trouble doing that just with the dog. So first thing, don't think someone else is going to call the authorities about the dog. If you see a dog, you're concerned about a cat in the car, you're concerned about, call the local authorities and report it to them. Get a description of the vehicle, the license plate, a description of the dog. If the owner comes out, I wouldn't recommend engaging them. Just report all the information to local law enforcement.
Okay, so you don't have to engage because that would be, yeah, definitely another worry that you would have. You would have not only a dog suffering, cat suffering, something in the, but also a very angry pet owner there coming out asking you. So just collect the information, maybe even step away from the vehicle if you want to stay there and watch, watch what happens and how the authorities respond.
Absolutely, but don't ever hesitate to call the authorities on this sort of thing. I've heard a lot of people give me the story that, well, I thought someone else would call about the dog in the car, and then we take a dog that's just severely heat distressed who wouldn't have been in as bad a condition if someone had called 5 minutes earlier.
Okay, good tips. Thank you so much, Scott Wilson, Animal Welfare Intervention Coordinator with the Animal Rescue League of Iowa. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you, Ben. You have a good day.
You too. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with IPR's Katarina Sestarek on how Iowa figures in a new CDC study on opioid use. Also, a self-defense class for Muslim women that started this week. Renewed concerns about the herbicide dicamba. Also, we recall the abduction and deaths of two Eastern Iowa girls that happened 5 years ago. It's a crime that remains unsolved. We'll talk about it in just a few minutes. It's your NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a few minutes. And we're back midstream in this NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll talk about renewed concerns about the herbicide dicamba, used on fields here in Iowa, but also perhaps on your lawn to control dandelions, for example. Also, toward the end of the program, we recall the abduction and deaths of two Eastern Iowa girls 5 years ago that remains unsolved. But first, let's check in with Iowa Public Radio reporter Katerina Sestarek about a couple of stories she's been working on. Hi, Katerina.
Hi, Ben.
I wanted to ask you about a couple of things you've been reporting on. A new study from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, on opioid prescriptions and where Iowa fits into the national picture.
Right. So the CDC, that's the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, put out a new study showing that basically prescribing for opioids peaked in 2010 and then dropped through 2015. But in Iowa, about a third of the counties actually increased opioid prescribing over that time period by at least 10%. So it sort of shows that while the national trend is decreasing, there's a lot of difference between counties. And in Iowa, some counties are actually increasing prescribing, even though the guidelines are to sort of limit prescriptions of opioids.
Mm-hmm. And the limiting comes through more guidance to doctors, or doctors saying, hey, you know, when you're prescribing these opioids, do it with more care?
Right. So the CDC just recommends limiting opioid use to people who have like short-term pain, like maybe after surgery, things like that, rather than continuously prescribing opioids, painkillers, you know, for people who have chronic pain for a longer period of time. And so I guess in states that have seen much higher rates of deaths from opioid prescriptions and things like heroin, states have put in more stringent laws to sort of tackle those prescriptions. And there they've seen a bigger decrease in prescriptions.
Mm-hmm. And again, remind us, often prescription opioids are a pathway that then eventually lead to heroin and addiction to heroin.
Right. So one thing that's being seen in Iowa right now is deaths from prescription opioid overdoses are dropping a little bit. They're still much higher than they were about 15 years ago, but they're dropping. But deaths by heroin overdose are increasing in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. So is there any way to tell whether the results of this study point the way forward to continuing to tackle opioid abuse in the country in Iowa?
Well, Iowa has been working on it. So like the Board of Pharmacy in Iowa is trying to make more doctors use the prescription monitoring program, which sort of helps doctors see if patients are maybe shopping around for opioid prescriptions and trying to prevent that. And they are also trying to, like the Department of Public Health is trying to raise awareness for patients to make sure that they're not using more opioids than they should be.
Katerina, another story you've been reporting on, I wanted to ask you about. Maybe our listeners heard this or not, but remind us about this. A self-defense class for Muslim women began this week in Iowa City. Is there a need for such a thing?
Well, Miriam Ammer, who's the executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations in Iowa, she said that this is a class that's open to everyone who feels vulnerable, but that in the past year or so, rhetoric against Muslims has been increasing, and there have been attacks against Muslim women throughout the country. So since Muslim women are maybe feeling a bit more afraid, a bit more targeted, mm-hmm. This was just something where she wants women to be able to feel prepared.
Mm-hmm. Well, what would be offered in such a class?
It's really just a basic self-defense class that's offered by a Taekwondo instructor in Iowa City. But it's just sort of meant to be like a safe space for Muslim women and any other women who feel vulnerable.
Okay, thank you very much, Katerina Sestarek, Iowa Public Radio's Eastern Iowa reporter. Thanks for stopping in.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week marks 5 years since two young Iowans, cousins, were abducted, 10-year-old Lyric Cook Morrissey and 8-year-old Elizabeth Collins. They were abducted after going for a bike ride in Evansdale. Their bikes were found in a trail adjacent to Myers Lake. Thousands of volunteers, if you remember, searched for them without success. 5 months later, about 20 miles to the northeast, the bodies of the two girls were found at Seven Bridges Wildlife Area in Bremer County. Now, 5 years after that abduction, still no one has been arrested in the case. Let's talk with Jeff Reinitz. He covered the case. He's a police and courts reporter at the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Ben.
You reported on this tragedy from the start. What are your earliest memories of covering this case?
Let's see. Well, I guess one of the things that really kind of stands out for me was kind of the setting out at Myers Lake. That was where the bikes were found. And it really served as a focal point kind of in the early, you know, the first few weeks of the investigation. It's, you know, kind of a good-sized park in Evansdale. It's got a lake in the middle. Their bikes were kind of found on the far side of it, and I think the initial suspicion was, you know, that maybe they had drowned. I think they had ruled that out pretty quick. But a lot of the investigation kind of took place kind of, you know, in that spot. So they'd have half the park was closed off, and law enforcement were kind of, you know, picking through looking for evidence, you know, out on the water, you know, looking for anything that might be underneath. Other half of the park was open up, and, you know, it was a good way for the community to kind of, you know, they could go there, they could, you know, talk to others. I mean, you know, everybody was, you know, scared and worried. Just kind of those first few weeks, it was just a place where they could go and, like I said, kind of a focal point. They could express their grief, their sorrow. They could talk with other members of the community. You know, law enforcement was out there doing their thing. You know, the parents would go there sometimes and, you know, hold little press conferences or talk to the media. You had candlelight vigils there. I don't know what they'd do with, you know, if there wasn't that thing, they'd be at home.
Right.
Sitting around being worried at home alone, I guess. I
wonder if you can recall for us, Jeff, sort of the chronology of how that progressed to when we started with the question, what happened to these girls? The bikes discovered, as you said, near Myers Lake, thought initially to be perhaps drowning victims. How did it progress from there, the thoughts and what was discovered after that?
Yeah, I think actually pretty early on, from what law enforcement told me, they were pretty sure they hadn't drowned, but it, you know, they had to rule that out, but they didn't, mm-hmm. you know, they didn't wait to do other things.
When were the arrows pointing to abduction though? What was there initially?
You know, I think that actually they had those suspicions pretty early on. I know as they were searching the lake, and it took, you know, maybe a few days before I think they started draining it, and then they got it to a certain point, then they brought in an FBI dive team with sonar, so that took a number of days for that to occur, and then for the dive team to get there. But at the same time, they were, you know, they had, I don't know if you want to call them roadblocks, but they had officers out in the streets that were, you know, going up to motorists, you know, quizzing, you know, asking them if they had seen anything out of place. They were, you know, it was trash day, I think, was a day or two later, and they had officers that were accompanying the trash teams, you know, the sanitation workers, as they were picking up trash, just to make sure that there wasn't anything suspicious that was getting thrown out. You know, those are some of the other things that they were doing kind of simultaneous with, you know, checking the lake and that kind of thing. And then checking, obviously, with people that knew, you know, family members, other people that might have seen or been in the area.
Right.
They were just, I know they were doing a lot of stuff.
When you think back at this time, you're reporting, covering the case, what conversations stick out for you in your memory reporting on this?
You know, some of the ones that really kind of stuck out for me was, you know, really just kind of your average person that maybe you'd strike up a conversation with, and, you know, can you tell me about yourself and why you're here? And, you know, it would be somebody that didn't particularly have anything, you know, personal connection with the girls or with the family, but, you know, worried community member, maybe a, you know, parent with their own kids, and, you know, you'd talk to them and they'd kind of express the, you know, kind of the worries that I think every parent would have and the concerns. And, you know, it's sort of those that really stuck out.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you can recall what it was like for you and your colleagues at the Courier covering this case. Did it give the newsroom a different atmosphere than it normally has?
Yeah, it was usually, you know, everybody's kind of working on their own thing and turning in their own stuff. And, I mean, you always kind of chat with each other. You know, back at the offices, you're typing things up, you know, about what you were doing. This was different because we were really kind of working in shifts. You know, we'd have, in the morning one person would, you know, go out to the lake, or they'd have briefings, I think twice a day at the Evansdale Police Department. So it was, you know, one guy would go out and maybe work one angle, and someone else would go out and work another angle, and then you'd, you know, midday maybe compare notes, and then, you know, pound the ground some more, and, you know, someone would go out and cover the afternoon press briefing at the police department. Yeah, it was just, you know, a lot of reporters covering, you know, kind of different aspects, different angles of the same story. So mm-hmm. there was
And the national media also took interest and descended on the area, didn't it?
Yeah. The, you know, big satellite trucks. You know, the kind of attention that we usually don't get that often around here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wonder. You mentioned that people unrelated to the case or who didn't know the kids who were abducted or their families, worried parents. Has this changed the way parents look after their kids in that area that you can tell? I don't know if you're a parent.
Yeah, and that's kind of one of the things that I kind of wrestled with. I've got two kids, and I like my kids to go outside and get fresh air and have fun and explore and get away from screens and that kind of thing. And, you know, I'm trying to get them out of the house to do stuff. And reporting on this, you know, you kind of really start to revisit that. And, you know, you're worried. You know, this guy is probably, you know, still out there.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And if he's not out there, there's probably others like him.
Right.
Or whatever.
5 years after the abduction of Elizabeth Collins and Lyric Cook Morrissey, no one has been arrested in the case. I don't know if you can add to where it stands today, the investigation.
You know, the investigators are always very tight-lipped about who they're looking at, what evidence they have. You know, there's really hardly anything that they've released. I'm sure they ruled out some people, but I don't think they've ruled out a lot of people.
Before we wrap up, Jeff, I just wonder, 5 years after the abduction, in a case that has not been solved, no one arrested for it, from your perspective as a police and courts reporter at the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, having covered many, many cases of crime, do you get the sense that this case will ever be solved, that the person or persons will be brought to justice?
Just kind of my own, you know, I think it, you know, there's a good possibility that they could solve it. I'm not privy to, you know, what evidence they have, where they're going, that sort of thing. But I guess you'd really kind of hope that they would, you know, in one way or another, if it's with the criminal charges or if it's, you know, some sort of disclosure years later that, you know, they were looking at this guy and this guy has died and, you know, or something like that. You really hope that something like this that they can close. But, you know, again, it's a big mystery. It's a question mark.
Okay. Jeff Reinitz covered the case, the disappearance, the abduction of 10-year-old Lyric Cook Morrissey and 8-year-old Elizabeth Collins 5 years ago this week, still unsolved. Jeff Reinitz of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, thanks for joining us.
Nope, thank you. Appreciate it.
a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, next we want to talk about a renewed concern about a very effective herbicide. It's called dicamba, a herbicide that can also cause problems when it drifts into a neighboring field, for example. Bob Hartzler is with us, extension weed specialist and professor of agronomy at Iowa State University. Hi, Bob.
Thanks. Pleasure to talk to you.
Bring us up to speed on what this herbicide is and the problems that have, well, cropped up. It's something called off-target movement, I guess, in the lingo of this.
Right. So dicamba is a very old herbicide. It was first introduced in the 1960s, and Iowa farmers used it widely in corn back in the 60s and 70s, and they still continue to use it. And it's very effective against broadleaf weeds. And so, you know, people who use herbicides on their yards to control dandelions, the herbicides they're applying on their yards probably does contain dicamba. So it's a very widely used compound. And because of herbicide resistance problems, companies are looking for new options. And new herbicides are difficult to discover, and so often it's easier to modify the crop to tolerate a different herbicide. And so that's
just like Roundup here.
Right. So Monsanto initially modified soybeans so they could tolerate Roundup, and now many weed species are resistant to Roundup, so they've modified the soybean again so it can tolerate dicamba. And so now farmers can spray dicamba on their soybeans. And one of the problems with dicamba and other related herbicides, such as 2,4-D, they're known as growth regulator herbicides, is they're very active at low doses. So if a small fraction of the herbicide moves out the field with wind and lands on a sensitive plant, it can induce crop injury. Usually it doesn't kill the plant, but it damages it. In some cases, it might affect the yield. And the real concern for many people in agriculture is probably the most sensitive plant to dicamba are soybeans that have not been modified to tolerate that. So in the landscape, we have Roundup Ready Xtend soybeans, and the Xtend soybeans are the ones that have been modified to tolerate dicamba. But then you also have other soybean varieties planted in the same area that have not been modified. Mm-hmm. And so if some of the dicamba leaves that field, and it only has to be a very small fraction of what the farmer is applying, it can cause significant damage. And so that's what we're seeing in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. In the minute or so we have left, Bob, what needs to happen, in your opinion, now that we're seeing this problem?
I think the EPA is going to have to evaluate the label and see if this system can coexist. I question whether or not we can continue to use the product, at least the formulations that are available now. There's just evidence that the potential for movement is too great and to cause off-target injury.
Mm-hmm. And we're hearing about instances in Iowa where it's become a problem, specific instances where it's drifted over into a neighboring field and caused the damage you said it can?
Right. I think earlier this week, Department of Agriculture, I believe, had 12 official complaints. But many times farmers try to work the issues out themselves rather than bring in the Department of Agriculture. So that the official complaints probably are the tip of the iceberg.
Okay.
We don't have a good handle on exactly how many fields have been injured.
Certainly a story to watch. Thanks for bringing us up to date on it. Bob Hartzler, Extension Weed Specialist and Professor of Agronomy at Iowa State University. Thanks for taking the time, Bob.
Okay, thank you.
And that brings us to the end of this News Buzz edition of River to River. I want to remind you that on Monday, I'll be talking with the author of a new book called The Good Governor, Robert Ray and the Indo-Chinese Refugees of Iowa. Matthew Walsh will be with us talking about his new book, taking us back to the 1970s and really the remarkable work that then Governor Robert Ray did, welcoming a lot of different refugees from Southeast Asia to Iowa in the aftermath of the Vietnam War. Also on Monday, I'll talk with Ambassador Kenneth Quinn. Former Ambassador Quinn spent 32 years working for the U.S. State Department. He served as the United States Ambassador to Cambodia. Also, he worked as a member of the National Security Council staff at the White House. Now, based in Des Moines, president of the World Food Prize in Des Moines. I'll talk with Ambassador Quinn on Monday. Just a heads up on that. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, with help today from Chelsea Hoy. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.